U.S. National Guard troops and vehicles are deployed in the city of Philadelphia following unrest sparked by the killing of an African-American man by police. Russia says it will provide assistance to Armenia in its conflict with Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh region if clashes spill over into Armenian territory. And more European countries are announcing tighter lockdowns as the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases soars across that continent. Hello and welcome from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story this hour takes us to the United States, where the city of Philadelphia has been put under nighttime curfew once again amid ongoing protests over the fatal police shooting of yet another African-American man. This is the second time the curfew has been imposed in Philadelphia this week. National Guard have been deployed there, with the city's mayor saying that forces will also be sent to critical governmental buildings and other infrastructures. Demonstrations began on Monday after 27-year-old Walter Wallace was killed by two officers who claimed he was approaching them with a knife. The victim's family says he was suffering from mental health problems. Since then, more than 200 people have been arrested, and a number of officers have reportedly been injured. Some businesses say they have been looted and vandalized during the rallies. Well, remaining in the U.S. now, the number of guns being sold has surged to record levels this year. Research shows Americans are stocking up on firearms amid a year of racial tension, and it all comes just days before the country's presidential election.
A new study has shown that so far in 2020, Americans have purchased at least 17 million firearms. According to Small Arms Analytics, this is more than any other single year since records began. Gun sales across the country had already seen a surge in the spring because of the coronavirus pandemic, but they spiked even higher in the summer of widespread protests and anger over systematic racism. The demonstrations began following the police killing of an African-American, George Floyd. Small Arms Analytics says by August, the U.S. had exceeded last year's total. By September, the U.S. exceeded the highest total ever. It added that the number of guns sold through the end of September 2020 is not only more than last year, it's more than any full year in the last 20 years we have records for. The revelation clearly highlights the levels of unrest the United States has witnessed this year.
There's been a tremendous amount of unrest here in the United States. There has been the Black Lives Matter movement. There's killings almost every day of black people by police and by white supremacists. So there's a real sense of panic among certain parts of the population.
According to the analytics company, the previous record for estimated firearms sold in a single year was 16.6 million. That was in 2016, when Hillary Clinton ran for president against Donald Trump and endorsed a strong gun control platform.
And that has been the pattern in American history. Sales soar when politicians indicate tighter gun control regulations following mass shootings. But what makes this year different is that President Trump has been very pro-gun. The record gun sales are actually due to the rising racial tensions and intense political polarization ahead of Election Tuesday. Well, citing concern over civil unrest, the country's largest retailer, Walmart, removed guns and ammunition from its shelves last week. The decision was reversed on Friday, but with just days before the election, worried owners of gun shops are boarding up their store windows. On the backdrop of violent unrest on the streets, Trump has added to the tension by repeatedly refusing to commit to a peaceful transfer of power.
Groups that advocate for an end to gun violence say that the surge in firearm sales will only increase the level of domestic violence. According to researchers at the University of California, gun purchases from March to May, linked to the coronavirus pandemic, were also associated with a nearly 8% rise in firearm violence across the United States. That's an estimated 776 additional shooting injuries. With much more ammunition on the streets, there's more fear across the towns and cities of America. A recent report by the Department of Homeland Security says groups and individuals with white supremacist ideologies pose the deadliest terror threat to the United States. Many of these right-wing extremists are armed and have also expressed support for President Trump. The fear is that deadly chaos could ensue if the country's presidential election on Tuesday is disputed by the incumbent. The eldest son of the late civil rights leader Martin Luther King says he fears that the election will bring about another civil war. Martin Luther King III said this is down to the kind of leadership the president has provided.
Without saying it, you know, the president doesn't say that, but he says what he needs to give people comfort in feeling that it's all right for them to say that this is what's going to happen. They themselves have said we might engage in some, we're getting prepared for the Civil War. But everybody is buying ammunition, and it's not one side, by the way. You've got Democrats and Republicans who are gunning up.
Gun owners say months of sustained demand for firearms this year has resulted in a shortage of guns and ammunition. Long queues have been seen at gun stores. The highest sales are adding millions of weapons to a nation that already has more guns than people. With increased political polarization, racial tensions, and anger at coronavirus deaths, as well as lockdown restrictions, those post-election fears are not going to disappear.
We'll continue with more news this hour. Iran's deputy foreign minister says the country's initiative for the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict is aimed at establishing lasting peace in the disputed region. Said Abbas Araghchi made the comment after visiting Turkey, the last leg of his regional tour that also took him to Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Russia. Araghchi said Iran's peace plan is based on international law, which urges the handover of occupied lands, among other demands. The diplomat said the initiative was welcomed positively by the four countries that he had traveled to. Araghchi said he had constructive talks during his trip. Armenia and Azerbaijan have been engaged in fierce fighting over the Nagorno-Karabakh region since late last month. Yerevan seized control of the mountainous region of Baku back in the 1990s war. The region is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan. Meanwhile, Russia says it would provide necessary assistance to Armenia in its conflict with Azerbaijan over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Russia's foreign ministry said it would offer help to Yerevan if clashes directly take place on Armenian territory. It, however, called on both sides to immediately halt the fighting. The announcement came amid the Armenian Prime Minister's request to Russian President Vladimir Putin for urgent consultations on security assistance. The developments followed three failed ceasefires between Baku and Yerevan. On Friday, however, the two countries agreed to a series of measures aimed at diffusing tensions and refraining from targeting civilians. Azerbaijan and Armenia have been engaged in a flare-up over Nagorno-Karabakh since September the 27th, leading to over 1,000 deaths. Well, search and rescue operations are in full swing following a deadly earthquake that jolted parts of Turkey and Greece. Rescuers are digging through heavy blocks of concrete in search of survivors from Friday's tremor that leveled buildings and killed at least 26 people. The quake caused a mini tsunami on the Aegean island of Samos and a sea surge that turned streets into rushing rivers in a Turkish town. Much of the damage occurred in and around Turkey's Aegean resort city of Izmir. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the epicenter of the magnitude 7 earthquake was some 30 kilometers off the coast of Izmir at a depth of 10 kilometers. Well, more European countries are announcing full or partial lockdowns as the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases soar across the continent. Greece has announced a partial lockdown, while England is considering imposing a second lockdown. Authorities in Portugal are also considering tighter restrictions. Meanwhile, the government of Slovakia has launched an ambitious program of testing the entire population of the country. Many other European nations, including France, Belgium, and the Czech Republic, have adopted tighter lockdown rules. Europe accounts for half of the COVID-19 cases globally, with an average of over 240,000 cases per day. Now to the UK, where the government there is reportedly considering imposing a new month-long national lockdown in England next week. Currently, the government has a three-tier system of restrictions for local areas. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a look at what our guests had to say.
Hello, welcome to the news review. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is reportedly considering imposing a new month-long national lockdown in England next week. Media reports suggest Johnson's move will potentially follow warnings from scientists that the coronavirus was spreading faster than their worst predictions. However, the new measure is still under discussion, as media reports, and no final decision has been made yet. The opposition Labour Party has already warned that a delay in introducing a national circuit breaker will mean the need for a longer lockdown that will do extra damage to the economy. Currently, the government has a three-tier system of restrictions for local areas in England, with level three being the highest. Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland have run their own policies on fighting the pandemic. Syed Poor is our correspondent joining us from London. We also have James Tweedy, journalist and commentator, joining us from Plymouth. Welcome. Syed Poor, is obviously this is something that was anticipated. So give us the latest that you have on that. But more importantly, I'm curious if there were any negligence that occurred on the part of the government when it came to not acting fast enough in order to prevent what is potentially said to be, and that's an estimate, of maybe 4,000 deaths to occur in the UK if this lockdown doesn't happen.
Whether or not this was negligence really is for people in the government or the opposition or people who are in the know to say, because this government has obviously been accused of being very slow into going into lockdown the first time around and back in March and hurrying out of it, hence probably the situation the country is in right now. But what I can tell you is some furious people this morning in the British government after that leak came out of the secret meeting that was taking place between the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the Health Secretary Matt Hancock, and the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove. And now we're also hearing that an inquiry has been launched into how that information got out, because apparently they were going to hold the announcement until Monday and come out and tell people what the new measures were going to be. And they're doing it apparently for two reasons. Number one, they're trying to control the number of infections because of this deadly coronavirus and bring down the numbers to prevent hospitals from being overwhelmed. And also the reason they're doing this is because they want to bring the numbers down ahead of the Christmas season, the Christmas holidays that will take place in December. Now, that is the situation at this point. But it is important to remember that all of this is happening at a very important time. The cases are going up. The furlough scheme that has supported some 9 million jobs since it was put into place is going to be scrapped as of the end of October, October 31st. So that is going to send shivers down the spines of people whose jobs will be at risk once the furlough scheme is scrapped. The support that the unemployed have been receiving will also decline. But what they have done, just going back to your earlier point, the opposition, some of the top scientists over the past month or so have been asking for what they call a circuit breaker, a full lockdown for a couple of weeks to bring the infection rates down. They resisted that, and now they're announcing a full lockdown. So we're probably going to hear from those scientists, from the Labour Party, that, you know what, we told you so, and you didn't listen.
Okay. Well, James Tweedy, looking at what can be said about this in terms of an analysis, obviously we can't fault the UK or any other countries in Europe or across the world, for that matter, for trying to handle this pandemic and not trying to let the economy get destroyed. But at the same time, there have been shortcomings, especially in the beginning of this pandemic when it hit the UK. How do you assess the way that the UK is dealing with this?
Well, I live in the southwest of England, and the infection rate here is very low. So the three-tier system that the new three-tier system that the government recently introduced, makes sense here, you know, because the lockdown is very disruptive to people's lives, and as it was disruptive, and you know, caused a certain amount of hardship and grief to people. So people I don't think people want that. And what we've seen is that in the areas where which have been put on the highest tier, the tier three lockdown, the local authorities have resisted that, and they've been very angry about it because it's creating problems in particularly in the hospitality industry. So one of the leading people opposed to that was the Labour Party mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham. But then there was a kind of contradiction in that, because he was saying that they didn't want that tier three lockdown because it's unfair on them, let's say, you know. But at the same time, the Labour Party was saying that we should have a deep lockdown, as they said, circuit breaker. Now we see that in Wales, that they have imposed a 17-day lockdown, and that's extremely unpopular. They've done certain things which are quite ham-fisted. They've banned supermarkets from selling what they call non-essential goods, which includes things like baby clothes, basic clothing, all sorts of goods, electronic goods, any kind of electronic goods, including things that you might need, like a mobile phone charger. So it's become unpopular. They did that because they told all the smaller shops to basically close, all the non-grocery shops to close, and they didn't want competition. But all that does is has sent more trade to online retailers like Amazon, that were already cleaning up and already putting all the high street shops out of business. So it's difficult. Now, my understanding right now is that the cabinet is meeting today. That's what I've just read, and that the decision might be announced earlier. They were talking about a higher tier, a tier four. I think your correspondent mentioned that, but we'll have to wait and see what they announce. So it's going to be rushed out. Okay. Certainly, members of the SAGE advisory group, which is an advisory group and does not make policy, have come out and briefed the media on what they think is going to happen with the virus. It's hard to tell where it's going to go. In terms of preparedness, actually during the first lockdown, the first wave of the virus, the government created a number of extra facilities that they call the Nightingale Hospitals to receive more patients. The one in Manchester is in use. I think there were 9 of them in total. They weren't used the first time round. The one in Manchester is now being used for normal patients. The other thing I'm going to say is that the problem with the lockdown, in a way, the first time, the response that was made by the health service was that patients who did not have the virus, were as many patients as possible, were discharged from the hospitals. That caused problems. Elective surgery, as they call non-emergency surgery, was cancelled. That's caused a lot of health problems in this country. And it would be, you know, and those problems are going to be repeated if the hospitals are told to clear the decks, as they say, to prepare for all these extra patients. In fact, what we've got now is we've got too much equipment. We've got more ventilators than we have nurses trained to use them. And this is where it's going. So the NHS wasn't overloaded the first time round. And I doubt it would be the second time round unless there's a particularly bad flu season, you know, winter flu season that coincides with the coronavirus.
Saipur is there, our correspondent from London. We appreciate it. And James Tweedy, thank you so much. Journalist and commentator there from Plymouth. Many thanks. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Dear listeners, the article you're about to hear has appeared on Fars News Agency website under the heading Empire of Chaos, a Decline. Stay tuned for more. Russian President Vladimir Putin has talked about what he sees as the end of the United States' world dominance. Addressing a meeting of Valadi Discussion Club think tank via a video link, President Putin added, "In terms of its economic weight and political influence, China is actively moving towards the status of a superpower. Germany is moving in the same direction. There is no doubt President Putin is right about America's decline because of its own geopolitical mistakes and where China and Germany, as well as many other sovereign nations, stand in terms of global economy, politics, and culture." In the midst of all this, therefore, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is wasting his time in Indo-Pacific in an attempt to contain China in the vast trans-regional space, which is shaping up to be the unofficial policy of the Empire of Chaos elsewhere in the world. In the Trump era, he is unlikely to have much to show to these regional nations, and he won't succeed with his unstated but heavily implied strategic goal. In India, Pompeo takes part in a meeting between the two countries' foreign and defense ministers. The two sides intend to sign the long-negotiated Basic Exchange and Cooperation Agreement. In Sri Lanka, Pompeo discusses the Millennium Challenge Corporation grant that the U.S. plans to offer the island nation. There have also been talks about a new Status of Forces Agreement. Both topics are very controversial in Sri Lankan society because of concerns they will make it more difficult for the country to retain its neutral foreign policy in the region. As in the Maldives, Pompeo seeks to celebrate the defense pact that the two countries clinched in September. He will also try to use economic means to lure the country closer to the U.S., just like he's trying to do in Sri Lanka. As for Indonesia, his problem is that the country rejected his request over the summer to host spy planes that planned to surveil Chinese positions in the South China Sea. Pompeo is desperate to prop up relations with a traditionally neutral nation, which is one of the founders of the non-aligned movement, after America's failed attempt to turn it against China harmed the trust that used to characterize their ties. He will also fail to court Indonesia to the U.S. side, and no significant progress is expected anytime soon. Taken together, the U.S.-related outreaches to India and the Maldives have succeeded to some extent, whereas they stalled in Sri Lanka and failed in Indonesia. The other trend is the efforts to boost India's standing as a regional counterweight to China. which implies supporting its aspirations in the Indian Ocean. This could backfire if they push too hard on nearby Sri Lanka and the Maldives, who seek to further improve their economic relations with China as a counterbalance. Lastly, the U.S. wants Indonesia to join the Quad again, while India is enthusiastically going along with the U.S. plans, with the mistaken expectation that it will improve its regional standing. Indonesia is respectfully declining to do so, preferring instead to remain on equally good terms with China. It can thus be said that their respective choices have left a lasting impact on the Indo-Pacific geopolitics, one which will influence the decision by others not to follow in America's footsteps. And that's just in Asia. Pompeo's anti-China containment mission has also failed in Europe. Although he scored some tangible success on the technical front, like forcing some European countries to ban China's Huawei and its 5G technology, he failed to stop many nations like Italy and Greece from joining China's Belt and Road Initiative, BRI, the world's largest infrastructure project. Without Europe on the US side, it's impossible to contain China and its Belt and Road Initiative. The same is true about America's political standing at the UN, where it failed to convince the Security Council to scrap the Iran nuclear deal or extend the UN arms embargo. Pompeo launched an onslaught against multilateral institutions at the UN, which included pulling out from the United Nations Human Rights Council, UNHRC, ditching the World Health Organization, WHO, leaving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, and a litany of other illegal actions. There have been routine violations of international laws and norms coming from Washington under Trump, but these are not unique to this particular administration. The previous U.S. administration similarly pulled out of the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO. They also repeatedly ignored the outcome of an International Criminal Court ICC case that found the U.S. violated international law through military aggression in West Asia. The Trump administration also went so far as to sanction ICC prosecutors investigating crimes against humanity by American troops in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. And this and more serves as further evidence that the empire of chaos is indeed in decline on multiple fronts, and that it can no longer paint itself as a moral leader in a globalized world where multilateralism and the fundamental norms of international law prevail. Trump and his top diplomat are unable to understand this. They are completely unaware and clueless, which only speaks volumes about President Putin's rhetoric about how deep and permanent the international decline and political ruts have become for the U.S.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Africa Today.
Western powers are increasing their military operations, especially secret ones in Africa. The former colonial powers have established more military bases in the continent. However, masses in some African countries have come out to oppose the presence of Western military forces, especially U.S. forces, in their countries.
We have seen where everywhere there has been permanent U.S. military presence, what it has attracted. It has attracted terrorism. It has attracted destabilization.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya.
And I am Sheila Nelima. Welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on military operations in Africa by Western powers, especially the U.S., and how they are destabilizing the continent.
In the second part of our program, we are discussing how the United States is forcing African countries to establish diplomatic ties with the Israeli regime and support its political and commercial interests.
We also have our weekly update of news and events from all parts of Africa. So stay tuned till the end.
Secret operations in Africa. There are several reports about secret military missions in Africa by the Western powers. At least 13 foreign powers have a substantial military presence on the continent. The U.S. and France are at the forefront of conducting both covert and overt military operations on African soil.
The pretext of Western military presence in Africa is combating terrorism. However, the presence of these foreign forces has led to an upsurge of deadly terrorist attacks across the continent.
Civilians have also borne the brunt of some of the secret military operations. This has especially been the case in Somalia, where U.S. carries out regular drone strikes.
For more on Western military presence in Africa, we contacted Daniel Lazar, a New York-based author and journalist. Thanks a lot for joining us, Mr. Lazar. What is the nature of the objectives that the world powers seek in Africa by their military presence?
Well, it's not quite clear what the goal is here. U.S.-African role was expanded in response to the war on terrorism. So the years 2007-2008 saw a major expansion. But the question is what the goal is. I suppose the goal is to contain terrorism, but of course it also involves expanding U.S. military influence, selling U.S. Weapons, establishing close relations with military leaders in Africa, and generally just sort of increasing the U.S. role in that part of the world.
Thanks for that, Mr. Daniel Lazar, author and journalist, and stay tuned for more.
The dramatic increase in Western military activities in Africa is a sad reminder of the brutal colonization. However, masses in some countries have come out to openly reject Western military presence. In 2018, thousands of Ghanaians protested in the country's capital, Accra, against plans to build a United States military base in the country. This was a rare public display of opposition to the growing Western military presence in West Africa.
This is an agreement where clearly it's not in our national interest. If you allow for a permanent U.S. military presence in our country. We have seen where everywhere there has been permanent U.S. military presence. What it has attracted? It has attracted terrorism. It has attracted destabilization. And we don't want Ghana to be destabilized. We also say that this agreement is lopsided, it's one-sided. There's nothing in it for Ghana apart from the dangers.
Following the protests, the president of Ghana, Nana Akufo-Addo, affirmed in no uncertain terms that Ghana has not offered a military base to the U.S.
So let me state with the clearest affirmation that Ghana has not offered a military base and will not offer a military base to the United States of America.
Mr. Lazar, how do you think the Western military presence in Africa endangers the socio-political situation and the everyday livelihood of people of the continent in the long run?
Well, they have a definite impact in terms of militarizing those societies. And that militarization takes place across a broad number of fronts. First of all, in terms of what's called terrorism, what we know as terrorism, military intervention often drives it to new heights. Rather than beating it back, it actually exacerbates it, makes it worse. I mean, the classic example is Libya, which is a country that was stable to a degree before the U.S. Intervened in 2011, and has since turned into a major stronghold for Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other such groups. And the same thing is happening in Somalia, where the Al-Shabaab seems to be increasing its influence, and Al-Shabaab is extending its influence into neighboring Kenya as well.
Mr. Lazar there has mentioned Libya, which plunged into chaos in 2011 when a popular uprising was halted by a U.S.-led NATO military intervention. Now, during a protest in Tripoli last December, the demonstrators were unanimous that foreign military intervention is the source of chaos in their country.
The West's military operations in Africa are allegedly aimed at battling terrorism. Have they been effective or just preparing the ground for more terrorists?
No, they have definitely backfired. There's no question that they've led to more terrorism. I mean, these interventions, these military activities are very disruptive. They're very violent, obviously. They kill local people, and therefore they spread anger and resentment wherever they take place. Anger and resentment against the U.S., of course, and that redounds to the benefit of terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab or ISIS or Al-Qaeda. So therefore, these military operations usually have a negative effect in the sense that they tend to exacerbate the problem they're supposedly combating.
Western powers are increasingly adopting a military approach in their ties with Africa to ostensibly combat terrorism. However, the ultimate objective is to plunder natural resources, including oil and minerals such as uranium, and counter China's influence in the continent. The militarization of relations between Western powers, especially the U.S. and African governments, has eroded good governance. Let's take a listen.
You have an increasing number of what they call small footprint bases throughout Africa. And so the U.S., rather than deploying large numbers of troops, is starting to create outposts where they can fly drones and other essentially robotic tools of war, and then also partnering up with unsavory militias or human rights abusing governments.
Have Western military operations in Africa negatively impacted on politics and governance in Africa?
Well, it does so by essentially militarizing those societies. And when you militarize those societies, you create bigger military establishments, bigger militaries, bigger armies. More of the national revenue goes to the purchase of advanced weaponry from the U.S., so therefore less money is spent on social services, for example, or education or healthcare. But it also encourages the military to take a more prominent political role, so therefore the military becomes the new center of power. And when that happens, the politics become more authoritarian, more militaristic, and less democratic. So therefore, you wind up strengthening all these tendencies, which essentially are negative in terms of the broad population of those countries, which do not need authoritarian politics.
Western military presence in Africa, whether it is covert or overt, leads to increased violence and instability throughout the continent. Sustainable peace and stability is achievable in Africa by finding African solutions to African problems.
And now we're going to present you with a package of news and events from Africa. What do you have to tell for us, Sheila?
Thank you, Henia. This week it's about bees versus elephants, an annual festival, but first. The Republic of Angola committed to the African Convention on Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources. The document was delivered to the African Union and requires all parties to take all measures for the protection, conservation, and sustainable use of nature. This becomes one of the several official ratifications adhered to by the Angolan state in 2020 alone. Others include treaties on cybersecurity, justice, and human rights. Now, Ethiopia has suspended its plan to privatize its national carrier. The decision was supported by the fact that the airlines appear to be doing well, being the continent's most successful carrier. The government stated that maintaining its capacity is more beneficial to the economy. Now, onto a sad reality. Borrow money to buy food. The situation in Nigeria. This is due to food inflation that has risen to over 16% during a period of months. The inflation is being blamed on the COVID-19 pandemic and the effect of shutting its borders with Benin and other West African states. Now, in other news, the South African government has committed to providing over $60 billion for the creation of job opportunities and infrastructure investments over the next 4 years. The commitment is part of the reconstruction and recovery plan aimed at reviving the economy following the COVID-19 outbreak. The government also adopted a new generation project that enables a more stable energy infrastructure with over 50% being sourced from renewable energy. Now, Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique has resorted into a beehive project to keep its elephants in. The project is to curb the conflict that has been caused by elephants crossing over into people's farms and destroying villages while looking for a snack. The beehive project is to improve conservation efforts by avoiding human retaliation. Now, the Visa for Music Festival took place in Morocco despite the pandemic. The annual program is a professional music market showcasing artists from the Middle East and Africa. Held in Rabat, Morocco, the festival includes conferences, training, and workshops. That's all we had for you this week. Don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
Africa.
The United States is now acting on behalf of the Israeli regime by pressurizing African countries to establish diplomatic and commercial ties with the regime. Kenya and Sudan are the latest victims of this U.S. policy.
The U.S. wants Kenya to support Israel's political and commercial interests or forget a free trade deal with Washington. According to the East African, a weekly newspaper published in Nairobi, the U.S. has indicated that the deal with Kenya should discourage politically motivated actions to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel.
The United States is also pressing Sudan to establish diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime. Washington recently removed Sudan from a U.S. list of states that allegedly sponsor terrorism. This is said to be part of a deal that will set the stage for Sudan to normalize ties with the Israeli regime.
Now, for an incisive analysis on this issue, we contacted Firoz Manji, an activist and professor of African studies at Carleton University in Canada. Thanks a lot, Professor Manji, for your time. Why is the U.S. forcing African countries to have ties with Israel for sanctions to be lifted or trade agreements to be signed?
The U.S. is insistent. Its policy is today to make sure that following Saudi Arabia, following the other Middle Eastern countries seeking to recognize Israel and to create those economic relations, it's a way of ensuring that the Zionist position is given strength from a complicit African regimes. And of course, our regimes are effectively, they are beholden to the U.S. And so we can expect that most of them will do the U.S.'s bidding.
Activist and professor of African studies at Carleton University, Canada.
The move by the U.S. to include a third party, the Israeli regime, in trade talks with Kenya has seen lobby groups in Nairobi warn that the agreement could be too risky for Kenya. Leonard Wanyama, the co-coordinator of the East African Tax and Governance Network, is concerned that U.S. demands might compel Kenya to alter its pragmatic foreign policy.
We could say that this would complicate Kenya's own foreign policy because it would mean that the country has to rewrite its own principles that it has been using in place since as far back as independence in terms of having a pragmatic foreign policy.
Professor Manji, do you think the Kenyan government will submit to U.S. demands and abandon the African Union position on Palestine?
I think that's a strong possibility. I think the president, Kenyatta, has visited Israel. We know that. There's a close relationship between Kenya and Israel, even if it's formally not acknowledged. But a lot will depend on whether citizens in Kenya will protest at this and make sufficient noise about this to prevent it happening. There is a very dynamic and strong anti-Zionist movement in Kenya, and so much will depend on civil society's ability to protest and make sure that there is not a breach in that relationship.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visited Sudan last August to push for a normalization deal with the Israeli regime. In February, Israeli regime's premier held secret talks with Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the head of Sudan's ruling transitional council in Uganda.
The talks triggered protests in Khartoum, while many political and religious leaders condemned the meeting.
هذا الخبر لو ثبت بأن الفريق الأول عبد الفتاح البرهان قد قابل الصهيوني بنيامين نتنياهو واتفق معه على التطبيع هذه خيانة لله ورسوله وقد فعل هذا الأمر عن غير مشورة من الشعب ولا عن غير رضا منه.
The Israeli regime is frantically trying to break its isolation by using U.S. influence. This pariah regime is bent on compelling African countries to abandon their historical support for Palestinian liberation. Why is the Israeli regime desperate on having ties with African countries and is intent on using unorthodox means to achieve this objective?
I think the battle is to legitimize the settler state, to legitimize the practice of anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab racism as a norm, and to normalize that the occupation of Palestine and the subjugation of its people is something that is central to that agenda. But to be able to get away with it, they need to have sufficient consensus internationally, at least to be seen to be complicit and in recognizing illegal occupation of large territories of Palestine.
Despite all its efforts, the Israeli regime has seen setbacks in its policy to extend its influence in Africa. Last year, South Africa downgraded its embassy to Israel. Opposition leader Julius Malema of the EFF party has taken a tougher anti-Israeli stance by calling on the country's government and the business community at large to cut all ties with Israel.
We are saying to South Africa, remove our embassy in Israel and then remove this one from South African soil.
What should African countries do to resist U.S. bullying and pressure regarding Israel?
Well, I mean, I think most, not all, but most of our governments are beholden to the U.S. And I can't see them offering any real resistance. However, there are amongst the population, I think there are significant movements and civil societies who could be organizing to put pressure on their governments to resist that pressure. And that has been a sort of constant battle.
Professor Manji there believes that it is only people's power and resistance that can stop U.S. and Israeli imperialism in Africa.
Numerous Sudanese political parties also lined up to declare their outright rejection of the normalization agreement between their country and the Israeli regime, stressing they're going to form a front to oppose the move. Sudan's National Umma Party, NUP, has rejected any normalization with the Israeli regime. The NUP's leader, Sadr al-Mahdi, said the transitional government, which is to remain in office until elections in 2022, has no mandate to make decisions on such controversial issues. According to Sudan's acting foreign minister, Omar Gamarettin, however, the accord will depend on approval from its yet-to-be-formed legislative council. The agreement sparked outrage among the public in Sudan, where pro-Palestine sentiment runs deep. Many Sudanese people have come out openly to speak against the deal.
That brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today, which focused on Western military presence in Africa.
And how the U.S. is pushing the Israeli agenda in Africa. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, it's goodbye for now and God bless.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.